This is Building Bridges, your community and labor report, produced and hosted by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
And now we welcome Jeffrey Sachs, who is director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University. He's special advisor to UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and is founder and co-president of the Millennium Promise Alliance, an organization dedicated to ending extreme poverty and hunger. He's authored numerous books, his most recent being Commonwealth, Economics for a Crowded Planet. One-sixth of the world's population remains trapped in extreme poverty, and now we're in a global financial meltdown. What is to be done?
This is the closest I think we've come to interviewing a rock star, but what's even more peculiar about it is an economist whose name is known internationally. So thanks for joining us, and that's a heck of a responsibility to live up to.
And my pleasure to be with you.
There was a rather prominent piece in the New York Magazine section with a woman by the name of Dambisa Moyo, native of Zambia, with degrees in public policy and economics from Harvard and Oxford. And she was incensed by what she calls debt aid, the bono phenomena of Western contribution, whether through prominent individuals or governments, aid to Africa. I was wondering how you respond to what she would seem to be saying is what I would think is an extraordinarily conservative position, which is people will pick themselves up by their bootstraps, and the pouring in of aid to African governments leaves people in a state of dependency and unable to progress economically.
I'm not going to mince my words. Her position is cruel and ignorant. I'm sorry to put it so starkly. Without targeted and practical help, millions of people will die because they're too poor to stay alive, and she should know better. To lump aid as if it's some giant morass of a stake in effort, and to not disentangle what's right and what's wrong, to not understand that aid, when directed towards vaccines or anti-malaria bed nets or antiretroviral medicines or bags of fertilizer, is life-saving and absolutely vital. This is irresponsible. There's a lot of this because people bandy that word around, but there's no such thing as aid in that generic sense. What there is are specific programs, some of which may be misguided, some of which are absolutely invaluable, and we have to understand which is which.
If I may switch to another direction, which is certainly a bit provocative, but I'm interested in your response, and that is, I guess, the Bono or the Angelina Jolie phenomena, or for that matter, the more extreme would be Selma Hayek being in Africa and breastfeeding an African baby. That kind of individualized attention to poverty from perhaps well-meaning but individualistic responses. How do you look at that within the context of really rising economies to the point of economic independence and prosperity?
I've worked with a number of the people that you've mentioned. Let me say, whether it's Bono or Angelina Jolie, John Legend, and many others, they're working very, very hard and very seriously at the underlying challenges. What they're doing is using their fame and their reach to help people understand issues that otherwise would not even be on people's radar screens. I've seen the effect. I've seen it close up. You joke of a rock star of an economist, but I'll tell you, a real rock star, it's a different thing entirely. Somebody reaches millions and millions of people and tells them it's important for them to understand the nature of extreme poverty, what can be done about it, what our governments ought to be doing about it. The work that these people have been doing has been incredibly eye-opening for a generation. I can't think of more valiant and valuable work. I just don't get the cynicism that's sometimes expressed about this because we live in a media age. Certain people have the headlines, the ability to reach large numbers. A lot of them absolutely squander that in the worst kind of nonsense. And some people take the opportunity to do very valuable work, and I think we ought to give them all the credit and thanks for that.
Dr. Sachs, first of all, thank you for bringing up the issue of aid rather than loan. We really haven't heard ideas about government aid since the 60s. It's been an emphasis on loans, yep. And especially during this time when the economies of so many countries have fallen apart because of the world economic crisis. But I'd like you to put that in some kind of context with regard to other things that affect the development of underdeveloped countries, and especially the prices that they get for their commodities and the wages that the workers get from the large U.S. and multinational corporations.
The problem of the very poorest people is mainly one of exclusion from any kind of economic system other than subsistence itself. To put it in perspective, I'm heading a project which we call the Millennium Villages Project, which is trying to help impoverished places to achieve the Millennium Development Goals of reducing poverty, hunger, and disease. It's quite striking, especially for an American like myself, to understand these villages, to visit them, to meet with people. These are places that often don't have a paved road, no electricity, often no clinic, no school. The water can be literally from almost what looks like a swamp filled with debris, very unsafe. People living as close to the edge of survival as one can imagine. You spend 5 minutes there, you think of 20 things that at extremely low cost could change people's lives, keep people healthy, and build the basic foundation for them to be productive. You raised a lot of issues about the unfairness and inequities of the market economy and the abuses. And I would add, for example, Halliburton just paid hundreds of millions of dollars in fines for its corrupt bribery of Nigerian government officials over the oil concessions. So the markets are filled with abuse, and boy, do we see that every day here. But the extreme poor are even below that level. It's not that they're being exploited, it's that they're disconnected, they're being excluded, they're living so close to the edge. That's a tragedy that I think is readily addressable if we're focused. And I know with the 500,000 people in the Millennium Villages how their lives have changed in just a couple of years at the investment of $60 per person per year in the village, almost nothing. But that's enough to help renovate agriculture, health, education, and basic infrastructure. I know that if we were thinking practically at a larger scale, we could turn the tide against the absolute most pernicious kinds of extreme poverty.
We had an opportunity to recently have a discussion with Professor Cornel West. One of the things that he said, and it really goes to the root of how we analyze the distinctions and the discrepancy and poverty within the world community, the distribution of wealth. He said, we're experiencing the sad gangsterization of America, an unbridled grasp at power and wealth and status, that capitalism is the root cause of these alleged losses, and that free market fundamentalism inherently trivializes a concern for public interests and breeds a fear and insecurity on the hearts of anxiety-ridden workers. And he goes on, but essentially what he's saying, which would seem to be very in opposite of your own position, is that capital is an inherently exploitative force that is going to take the resources and warp and destroy the economies of nations that have been underdeveloped. How do you continue to analyze and look at that root of poverty within the world community?
I think what Cornell was describing is very apt for the kind of extreme form of capitalism that many in this country have advocated, and very different from what you and I would believe to be the right kind of economic system. There are many forms of capitalism. They're not all like this kind of unbridled, unregulated, wild west, and really cruel form that we had in the United States and championed, and that the financial markets used to pay themselves mega bonuses and help bring the world to the brink of economic collapse. There's a different kind of capitalism, which I admire and I've lived in and with and studied extensively, and that's the kind of capitalism, for instance, in Denmark or Sweden or Norway, also rich countries, market-based economies, but they don't let poor people fall through the cracks. They don't say, if you can't afford it, you don't get health care. They say that it is a social responsibility that everybody should be able to meet not only basic needs, but in those cases, really to live a proper life within their societies. And they acknowledge right from the start, this means people are not invited to get super, super rich. They're invited to be part of a society where, yes, you can become wealthy, but no, you can't run the show and then turn your earnings into political power and get your taxes cut further and be deregulated and pay yourself billions of dollars of bonuses corruptly. The result is societies that don't have the kind of poverty we have, societies that don't have the kind of lack of protection of health care, societies that don't have kids not able to go on as much as they have the potential for in education and so on. So the only thing I would add to what Cornell has said is that capitalism is a big word in the sense that it embraces lots of very different kinds of societies. It happens that the version we've had in the United States in the last 30 years is the most unequal version of it and led to tremendous abuse, and it led to instability that's brought us to our crisis.
The crisis has been getting much worse, emanating first from the U.S. and spreading worldwide and affecting underdeveloped countries on a massive level. But Obama recently has cut back on his ideas about aid. Originally, he was going to double economic aid, but now with his concern over balancing the budget, he's cut that back. How do we wrestle with our own economic problems and help the poor and the rest of the world, which is getting worse?
We have to keep the help for other countries in perspective. It's tiny. And we have been giving in aid about $5 billion per year for all of Africa, the poorest part of the world. Look what Merrill Lynch paid itself in bonuses in December out of taxpayer dollars, $4 billion, almost what we give in aid for 800 million people. The first thing we have to do is demystify this aid level because people are afraid of it. They think it's our money going down the drain. They don't understand often that it is life-saving, vital, and insufficient to meet the basic needs. So we have to keep the numbers straight. When we do that, I think we have to help the president to face domestic politics. I think the president's vision is right, but he's being pulled by conservative ideas and conservative forces. We need to understand and help the rest of the country understand that $1 trillion spent on the military is money down the drain compared to 1/100th of that directed at solving the underlying problems of extreme poverty and hunger, and to just get our investment budget in our foreign policy far better directed than the way we've been doing it up until now.
You've been a critic of the IMF and its policies around the world. I wonder if you can help us parse out two things. One, the question of aid, because so often it has come with structural adjustment and various attachments that warp the economy and put strains on governments that invariably inure to the deficit of the local populace. And what is the aid that we're talking about? Is it essentially credit and microloan programs?
When it comes to the IMF, that's a very particular institution, and it lends money fairly short term, a few years for total repayment to governments, but it lends it in a way that the money can hardly be used. Basically, the IMF says, okay, we'll give you money. Yeah, you can put it in the window to show you have the money. Maybe you can draw down a little bit of it, but what we really want you to do is cut your budget deficit, get your spending under control, and so on. These programs have often been absolutely draconian. They haven't really been helped. They've been almost enforcing austerity. Now, the IMF has backed off of some of that structural adjustment in recent years, not enough by any means. And what the IMF gives, I wouldn't call aid at all. It's short-term loans with often, tragically, tough conditions attached to it. Now, what the IMF sometimes says is, oh, don't blame us. Blame government like the U.S. and European governments who aren't giving the development aid that's needed for these countries. And there's some merit to that. That the IMF is set up as a kind of short-term bank. It's not really a development lender. But on the other hand, I would like the IMF to be far more outspoken to say, look, we can't squeeze these countries like this. This is doing huge damage to real people as well as to their economic prospects. And I'm still worried that even in this crisis, when the rich countries can afford to spend and are spending trillions of dollars to try to dig themselves out of this hole, that what's going to the developing and the poor countries is basically scraps at best. This is very, very dangerous. And when we say, well, why should we do it for someone else? part of the answer, very simply, is this is a crisis that started in the rich world, and it has absolutely smacked down, walloped the rest of the world, and we have some responsibilities to help address that.
Could you lay out both the kind of aid you're talking about and the mechanisms, the vehicles, whether it be the UN, the U.S. government, some new agencies? What do you propose, and in terms of that, how significant is that compared with changing U.S. and other countries' behavior toward the third world in terms of the economy? Is it just aid, or do we need a whole range of policies?
We need a partnership that says we've got common problems, because these really are common problems, that we should be honest enough to say we caused a lot of those problems, whether it's financial crisis or climate change crisis, and that we need to work together to solve them. There are, in specific, a number of very important, often life and death things that need to be done. And I think that we could stress four of them right off the top. One is the hunger crisis. Its solution depends on impoverished peasant farmers being able to grow more food for themselves. So I've proposed a special fund to help smallholder farmers, farmers with an acre or two of land that are trying to feed their families. And these are women farmers that typically that are doing this backbreaking work to get the help they need, soil nutrients, better seed, small-scale water management, so that they can double or triple their output. Second is on the health side. We have still 9 million children under the age of 5 dying every year of utterly preventable causes, whether it's infections, malaria, or infections that could be prevented by vaccination or unsafe drinking water, lack of antibiotics or a respiratory infection or a childbirth that was not done in antiseptic conditions. The public health community has really sorted out very well how to reduce these deaths, suffering, and solve the problems. And it doesn't cost very much money, but we've not stepped up to do it. The third area is education, ensuring, as we promised and promised and promised to do, that every child in the world would have the chance to be at a school with a classroom of at most 40 students, not 150 students, with some supplies and a roof over their head and a light bulb in the school and even a computer and so forth. Very inexpensive. Countries have made plans, but they're too poor to implement them. We can partner. The fourth area I would emphasize is the basic infrastructure, the power, the roads, broadband connectivity, that are the foundation of any economy. Without that foundation, no economy can move forward. This is an area where our factories could actually sell a lot of goods to poor countries. And if we created a long-term development financing strategy so that either in grants or at very low interest long-term loans, 40-year loans, we would help these places build out their basic infrastructure. That would be good for our industry. That would be good for stimulus. That would be good for development. And if we were rolling out solar power, for example, which is Africa's number one energy potential, then we would also be making a triple win, including environmental sustainability. This is all pretty practical. There's a lot of management work, design work, project work, monitoring, implementation. Nothing that is so complicated that you say, well, gee, I don't even know how to attack the problem. Each of these challenges has an identifiable solution, strategy, financing, and delivery mechanism. Nothing has to be left to, you know, unmarked envelopes filled with cash handed over to corrupt leaders. That's not the kind of aid that any sane and serious person would be talking about, and that is often viewed as the only way that aid is given. It's just about the opposite. What we need is targeted investment strategies. Now, to do each of these things, you need to invent the kind of organizations that can get the job done. I worked with former Secretary General Kofi Annan to help establish the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, Tuberculosis, and Malaria. And that was established in 2001, and for the last 8 years, it has been providing life-saving solutions, covering hundreds of millions of people in the fight against malaria. It's been spreading effective responses against AIDS and TB. So you took a problem, identified the way it can be done, figured out the financing, created an organizational model that could get the job done, and indeed, it's a success story.
just prior to the election of President Obama, there were a number of recommendations you made to the U.S. government and administration that was about to assume the reins. And just to get you started, because I'd like you to elaborate on some of them, one was to end the Iraq war immediately. Of course, now we see the possibility of 30,000 more troops being revved up to go into Afghanistan, and the tax cuts, invest in sustainable technologies. And I wonder if you can continue and give us some of those highlights of what you think were critical areas to address that go to the area, clearly, of international poverty.
I said that we ought to take these challenges seriously, and I tried in every one of these recommendations, not just to list a headline, but to explain how it could be done. Iraq, well, maybe we're on path, I'm not sure, but I certainly, let's encourage and insist on the president following through that we absolutely get out of Iraq. We can't afford it, and not get out of Iraq so we can get into Afghanistan. That is a losing proposition, I have to say. It can become the next quagmire for us. The rollback of the tax cuts on the higher income was postponed this year. I wasn't too happy about that. Frankly, we need the revenues, but I expect in the budget that the rollback for the upper income households on the Bush tax cuts will be in place. I recommended an envoy be sent to China quickly to start engagement on climate change. Now, they did one better than that. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton went to China right at the beginning of the administration. Good call. Very smart that she emphasized the economy and climate in her discussions with the Chinese leadership. I advocated that we convene a global summit at the White House for the water crisis in the world. Part of the reason is that a lot of the most unstable places in the world, like Somalia, Sudan, Yemen, Afghanistan, are water-stressed places. I would add Gaza, by the way, tremendous water stress, which leads to hunger, lack of jobs, desperation. If we said we understand it isn't all politics, it's not about Islamic extremism, this is about real people, real lives, real desperation. And we're going to work together on best technologies, the best practices, investment in water infrastructure to help solve the problems. I suggested we immediately restore our funding for the UN Population Fund for family planning. I'm very worried about the continued rapid rise of the world's population, which is occurring in the world's poorest areas. In each of these areas, and there are more, in the proper funding for the Global Fund to fight AIDS, TB, and malaria, and in taking on the challenge of hunger through funding smallholder agriculture and other things we've discussed. These are areas where the U.S., at very low cost, divided by the bonuses the Wall Street pays itself for the tax cuts or the stimulus, and you'd find it's tiny, at low cost, we could be leaders of solutions to huge global problems, and that'd be the right place for America, because not only would it be deploying our technologies, but it would be showing the kind of leadership that can make the world safer and can make America a lot safer.
Speaking of Wall Street, would you like to weigh in on the current controversy over a nationalization of some of the insolvent banks?
It's basically straightforward. I don't think it's too complicated. If a bank is insolvent, it needs to be nationalized. What that means is the shareholders don't have value because their assets in the banks are outweighed by the liabilities. We don't just let the bank crumble because we protect the depositors in this country in order to keep a stable monetary system. That's the right thing to do. But if the shareholders don't have value, the government ends up bearing the liability to make good on the deposits, and the government therefore has to take over the bank, clean it up, and either whittle it down, somehow merge it with a healthy bank, or resell it in a cleaned up form. There's no way that the taxpayers get out of this hole, because we have promised, rightly, that the depositors won't lose money. We do that to avoid the kind of Great Depression bank-run calamity. That sets the taxpayer up to bear the burden when the assets no longer cover the bank deposits. To leave this in private hands when it's a bad bank like this makes no sense. So the government's statements about this are really not very clear, in the sense that they've said we prefer a private-run banking system. Well, everybody does. Who doesn't? Nobody wants the government to run the banking system. The question is, what do you do when a major bank is insolvent? And the answer is, it has to be taken over, cleaned up, and then reprivatized.
I'm interested in whether you think it might be a good idea, assuming that banks are nationalized, to keep one or two of them in the public hands to compete with the private sector, since the private sector has failed so abysmally in this area.
That's a very interesting question. I think we're going to hear some proposals in the budget about some kind of new development banking structure. I don't want to get ahead of the president, and I don't know exactly the details, but I think that there's some movement towards some kind of public finance. And that would go in the direction of your question.
Lastly, in your New York Times bestseller book, Commonwealth Economics for a Crowded Planet, you're extremely optimistic about technologizing the underdeveloped nations and causing them to rise out of poverty. Since the book has come out and there has been the exacerbation and explosion of the global economic crisis, are there any things you'd like to punctuate or add as a postscript to the book?
Read the book and do it more urgently. Because, you know, the situation has gotten worse dramatically in the last year. They've lost remittance income. Their workers are being sent home as the work permits go away in the Middle East or Europe. Export earnings are down. Unemployment is rising. They're suffering a crisis they had nothing to do with, but is coming like a tsunami hitting these societies. They're also suffering from the continued and worsening climate change shock. The urgency is there, but the ability of technology to make a difference really is phenomenal. And there's one technology that is actually being spread by markets alone. Bed nets for malaria, no. Vaccines, no. Markets don't do that kind of thing. But one technology is being spread by markets, and that's cell phones. And so when you observe mobile phones in what were the most remote places in the world and how it changes life to be able to call in an emergency or to be able to find out where to sell a goat or a camel that can earn some income for the family. You see the power of the technologies that we do have if they can be deployed. But for the real life and death issues, for hungry people, for people without health care, for children without schools, for communities without water and sanitation, markets are not going to solve those problems. That has to be a cooperative effort. That has to be the realization that we really are in this together, that our global crisis is a global crisis because of our common fate, and that the way out of this is by investing in the future and investing together. And I think it is the way to make a safer world.
Thank you again for being so gracious. I really appreciate the time spent and the quality of the interview, and I hope the questions were things that elicited from you what you would like to also see happen.
Well, I want to thank you because you know a tremendous amount about these issues, and it was very distinctive and thoughtful questions, and so I'm really grateful for that.
We've been talking to Professor Jeffrey Sachs on extreme poverty around the world and what is to be done.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our new website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.